Matter of Kathleen Delanoy versus Township of Ocean. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honor. Donald F. Burke, Jr., Law Office of Donald F. Burke, Brick, New Jersey, for the plaintiff, Kathleen J. Delanoy.
Good morning, judges. Your Honors, excuse me. Lori Dvorak from Dvorak & Associates on behalf of the defendants.
Good morning, Deputy Attorney General Feng Yi Fu for the New Jersey Attorney General as amicus.
Good morning, Jean Lo Cicero from the ACLU of New Jersey Foundation on behalf of 12 gender equity and reproductive health advocacy organizations as amici.
And good morning, Your Honors. This is Benjamin Folkman. I am amicus curiae for the New Jersey Association for Justice.
Morning, counsel, and welcome. Ms. Dvorak, please go ahead.
Thank you, sir. This morning, we're here on an issue with regard to the construction of the Pregnancy Workers Fairness Act. Quite frankly put, as the appellate division recognized, the act requires employers to provide pregnant workers with reasonable accommodations that can enable them to perform the essential job functions. While there are many issues that the amici have discussed that deal with the construction of the law in a global sense, and I understand their concerns and the concerns of women in the workplace, but in this particular case, we have undisputed facts that Ms. Delanoy said she could not perform the essential functions of her job. Her job was that of a police officer. A police officer must be able to, by definition, fire a weapon. They must qualify. As this court is aware from its prior decisions and decisions throughout the courts of the state of New Jersey, failing to be able to qualify and utilize your firearm is a basis to discharge a police officer from employment. She walked in and said, I can't fire a weapon, as she acknowledged in her deposition. She couldn't engage with suspects or any number of things she couldn't do, but her essential job functions, that of a police officer, assigned to patrol, was something she could not do. And there was no reasonable accommodation that we could give her that would have allowed her to perform the essential functions of her job during this time. I completely acknowledge that if, for example, her concern was a belt holster for the weapon going around her midsection, if she asked for a shoulder holster, that would have been a reasonable accommodation to give her. Perhaps her assignment in a patrol district versus her assignment as a school resource officer would have been a change of assignments, but still performing the essential duties of a police officer. This is not what we're talking about in this under our facts. So the one point that I would like to just emphasize is that while I certainly do understand all of these protections for women who are pregnant in the workplace, we are talking about performing their essential functions, because when they are not performing their job, someone else is performing their job. They're performing someone else's job. If it is a swap, for example, between an evidence room person and a patrol officer, and we're swapping two officers out temporarily, that to me is what this law talks about when it says a temporary, less strenuous assignment. But what we have here is creating a new assignment that does not involve the essential elements of the job. This is a person who came in and said, I can't do my job. I would like somebody else's job, not another police officer's job, but basically a civilian level job, because I need those accommodations. And that's fine. But that came with full police officer salary, full police officer, creditable, honorable pension credit service time, full pension contributions. And as a result, the request of the township was, in order for us to do that, that you kick in and you participate in our program as we see fit, and that you, along with those who are injured or sick by means of a non-pregnancy issue, you will all have access to the same benefit, which is that you can come back to work and we'll create this other job, but you have to participate a little bit. So as you use your time, we will help you out. Because otherwise, the alternative is a large bank of unpaid leaves that are available to these injured, sick, or pregnant officers, but none of which that come with full salary and pensionable honorable service credit. So in that regard, our emphasis is on the fact that if this was a question of she could perform her essential functions with a reasonable accommodation. That is not what we have here. That is not what we are arguing about. I understand everyone else is talking about that, but that's not the facts of this case. With that stated, the other point that I wanted to talk about a little bit was, is our two policies. Obviously, the issue comes in is whether our policies on their face were facially equivalent. And when the law passed, we were involved in litigation. And this policy, though, is a policy of the chief of police. It is not a township ordinance. It is not a resolution. It is not anything that was passed by the governing body. This governed was created by the chief of police and promulgated as applicable to the police department. My point simply being, and I acknowledge best practices would say in hindsight, yes, the language could have been better, but the person who creates the policy can create any exception to it. And quite frankly, there is no admissible information other than a hearsay certification that says this was ever applied in anything other than a completely fair and even manner. Our rules of court and our rules of evidence still say you have to have admissible information to defeat a properly supported summary judgment motion, and we simply did not have that in this case. Ms. Delanois only came forward with, I was told that someone else said this. We don't have any information, and the testimony of the chief was that that never happened. So as we move forward in this matter, clearly I think two things stand out in my mind. One is that we are not dealing with someone who could perform their essential functions with a reasonable accommodation. And second, that any discrepancy or disequality in the plain language of the statute was never actually applied, is in fact now moot because the statutes were rendered, the policy was rendered equivalent many years ago. And that never happened to Ms. Delanois. We still have that proximate cause issue of she was not treated any differently than anyone else who was sick or injured at the time. With that said, unless anyone has any questions, I would like to reserve a little bit of time at the end.
Counsel, if I'm hearing your argument correctly, and tell me if I'm mistaken, you're saying that the township's light duty policy was a matter of grace, and because the plaintiff was unable to perform the essential duties of the job, you could have fired her. Not only could you have fired, tell me, am I right about that?
Respectfully, no, I don't believe we could have fired her. She had leaves available to her, but they would have been unpaid leaves. FMLA and the like would have, in order to her benefit, there may have been provisions under her union contract or other things.
Okay.
We are certainly not saying that we could have fired her. We're just saying we would not have been obligated to pay her full salary as a requirement under each and every type.
Okay, so then you could have at least removed her during the period of her pregnancy, during the course of her pregnancy, and force her to take sick time, family leave time, comp time, and all other types of time.
We are saying that when she came in with a note that said she can't perform the essential elements and she acknowledged that, we are saying that yes, we did not have at that point initially any basis by which to do anything, hence the policies that were implemented, which said we can do some of that.
So are you challenging the appellate division's determination that there was a facial problem with the policy that was created for pregnant law enforcement members and for other law enforcement members who required light duty because of injury or illness?
It's a tricky answer, and I apologize because I don't mean to be saying this. I am saying that the policies have since been changed, so the issue I believe is moot. And I am saying that the policy that was implemented by the chief was just that, the chief's policy. He was the one who could have considered or changed his policy at any time. So
I think
that—
Could the chief change it back?
I'm sorry?
Could the chief change the policy back today?
I'm going to say, if knowing what we know now, the chief has the power to promulgate policies just like any policymaker, but the chief understands, and I think it's now a different chief, but we all understand what the requirements of a policy are. And in this case, the chief can promulgate any policy, but any policy can always be held to be improper, unconstitutional, violative of a statute, whatever the case may be. He has the authority to promulgate policies, but not improper policies.
I'm hearing a bit of an echo. I hope we can deal with that. If the policy could be reversed yet again, is this case really moot?
I'm sorry, I'm not following.
If the chief could go back and reverse the change that you're highlighting for us, is this really moot?
Well, in that sense, it's a hypothetical question because it has not happened. I understand that policies, and we understand the policies need to be facially valid, but the question before the court is moot because there are no invalid policies at the present time. Best practices would absolutely dictate that should not exist and has not existed for quite a substantial amount of time. And certainly there is no plans or thoughts or even whims of ever instilling that. But nonetheless, the chief can, as a matter of authority, promulgate policies. If they are improper, then they are challenged and voided.
Are you asking us to overturn the appellate division judgment that held the policy that has since been changed facially invalid under this pregnancy discrimination law?
I guess what I am asking is that the court acknowledge that determination is moot at this point.
I'm asking you your position.
No, I believe the policy is invalid when they were unequal, but I believe the question before the court is moot because the policies no longer exist in that fashion. They have been made identical at this point and have for a substantial amount of time that this matter has been in litigation.
Can you address why you believe the appellate division was wrong to remand the issue of summary judgment and send this matter back for further proceedings?
Yes, thank you. I think because the appellate division determined that a reasonable accommodation was required in this matter, in light of the fact that we have undisputed testimony that Ms. Delanoy could not perform the essential elements of her job, even with a reasonable accommodation. I think the distinction is simply that if there's something we could have done to help her perform the essential functions of her role as a police officer, then I would look at this in a very different light. But we are starting from the factual predicate.
Counsel, has the legislature really made a distinction now between essential duties and other duties? I'm looking at 10:5-12, and it seems that the legislature realizes that pregnant women may not be able to perform the so-called essential duties. And that's the reason why, and I'm quoting from the statute, they provide for restructuring or modified work schedules and temporary transfers to less strenuous or hazardous work for needs related to the pregnancy when the employee based upon, and then the rest of the statute goes. And it seems to me that if providing light duty in a case like this or restructuring provides a hardship, then you've got to make out the hardship case. But this essential duties does not seem to be consistent with the statute. It seems as though you're supposed to make a reasonable accommodation, for instance, light duty, as you provided over here. If you can't do it because of hardship, then you've got to make out that case. Why is that not the correct template?
Well, initially I would note the appellate division, even though it's from their decision that I come before you, even the appellate division noted on page 16 that the provisions require employers to provide pregnant workers upon request with reasonable accommodations that can enable them to perform their essential job functions. And when dealing with police officers, specifically as we are in this case, a police officer is the position. The assignment is to patrol or to planning and training or to a detective.
But they perform other duties. For instance, you have to have a police officer at the front desk. There are police officers who handle evidence. There are police officers who handle records. There are all sorts of other functions, dispatchers. There are all sorts of other functions in a police department other than patrolling with a gun on your hip. Am I correct?
And I agree. And that is exactly my point. If Ms. Delanoy had come in and said, may I have an assignment to planning and training or to the evidence room, or can I wear a shoulder holster and be a DARE officer? That I think is completely different than coming in and saying, I can't perform my essential functions. Can I be a records clerk, if you will? And I'm not trying to attribute that she did, but when she said, I can't do the most, I'm not talking assignments here. I understand and I acknowledge
that. Did you offer her a DARE officer position?
She was not offered a DARE officer position.
So then why are you giving that as an option if she wasn't offered it?
I'm giving it as an option because I'm trying to explain what I see as the distinction between an assignment with essential functions and Ms. Delanoy's predicament where she came in and said, I cannot perform essential functions.
Well, she said she cannot go on the road. So then you should have been offering the other positions available to her as a pregnant woman. Records, dispatch, DARE officer, and the other things. Did you do that?
No, because dispatch is not a sworn police officer. We offered her, what was available to her was based on what she told us she could do.
What about the job of dealing with the public? When the public, members of the public will walk in, and the job that she was doing, is that ordinarily a job that a police officer would fill? And how prior to her being in that job, how was it handled?
My understanding is when members of the public come in, depending on what is being asked, if it is to take a report, that can be a police officer function. If it is to obtain a report, that would be a records civilian function.
Right. Okay. But is it the practice? Let me ask it a better way. Is it the practice of the department to have a police officer on hand to deal with questions or report? Someone walks in and wants to make a report.
No. They would bring someone on an as needed basis and off the road and pull them from their patrol duties if there is a walking complaint pre-COVID.
You started to say what positions were offered to her that she would have been able to do even with her limitations. What were they? I didn't get all.
I don't mean to suggest they were in fact offered, but looking at what is available in a police department, if she had come in and said, I have some limitations, but what other positions are available for me? And this is based on a lawyer looking at a police department, someone who works as perhaps a school DARE officer who would be wearing a
shirt. No, I remember the list of things you said that
there. I'll repeat my list.
You started to answer a question by saying, what was actually offered to her? Was any of those positions offered to her or assignments?
No, because her note came in and said, I need light duty. I can't perform those functions. I can't carry a gun. I can't chase a suspect. I can't do any of those things.
Does the record, the person in the office that handles the evidence, do they have to be armed?
I'm going to say I'm fairly certain. I believe they would leave their weapon outside of the evidence room, but I don't know that to be 100%.
I guess what I'm getting at is if you have the title of police officer, is there a requirement that you, for any police department under our statutes, rules, regulations, attorney general directives, whatever, that you carry a weapon and you'd be able to do certain functions if you have the title of a police officer?
I believe you are carrying a weapon unless you are in a prisoner cell block area where you secure your weapon before you go in and deal with prisoners in a municipal cell block, much like corrections officers do. You don't bring weapons into the cell block area.
So even if she was assigned DARE officer, she would have to have or be able to carry a weapon?
Yes.
Let's come back, if you would please, to the wording of the statute, because there are and will be pregnant police officers in every department throughout the state. What temporary transfers to less strenuous or hazardous work exist for those many instances?
I would say to give you a list to be assigned if they have an evidence officer. I would say a DARE officer being involved in the schools, perhaps a juvenile detective, certainly, and just trying to think back through, I had some in my brief, if I can have a moment to find my list. Someone assigned to traffic, reviewing reports and the like in the traffic division, not necessarily on the road taking the report, but inside the traffic division, planning and training, grant writing, any of the administrative assignments within the department would all predominantly put that person handling gun permits, for example. It would be a matter of dealing with paperwork that a sworn officer has to do, but would be inside the building, sitting at a desk, still being armed. The question comes to mind, if there is a serious incident and everyone has to get up and go and respond to an emergent active shooter situation, do you have enough staffing that you can handle that?
So the statute also tells us that the employer shall make available to the employee the reasonable accommodation. Did you? And are you arguing that there is no such accommodation in light of the last example that you gave us?
Well, I'm saying that when people need to go out, for example, and I'll deal with the second question first. The last example is if people need to go out, someone, you don't leave the station alone. She can then, a pregnant officer would then be able to be someone at the station and the other officers would be able to go out. In the situation where if we have an unarmed officer who's unable to carry a weapon, we are then limited in what else can happen. My theory in my argument is if a pregnant officer takes an inside job, if you will, someone working inside of headquarters, the person inside of headquarters can go out on the road. And it is no longer a matter of luck or lottery that these officers are switching back and forth in their assignments. It's a matter of, we have another position, we will switch the officers temporarily. It is less hazardous, it is less strenuous, but it is still a police officer duties, receiving police officer pay and police officer pension credit. If she is not able to do police officer duties, that is where I think our provision came in, and that is where these other provisions occur in the world of police, which is a little different than many other aspects of our employment in the rest of the world.
Assuming you have to make this a reasonable accommodation, let's say you have to provide a plaintiff such as this, a DARE officer position, it, under the statute, that's the reasonable accommodation. Are you then permitted to require the pregnant officer to give up leave time? Why does that not constitute a penalty under the statute, that you're actually penalizing her by now forcing her to give up leave time?
No, my position would be is that if she was able to accept the position as the DARE officer, there would be no leave time given up. There would be no, that requirement would not ever trigger because she would be in a different assignment with full duties.
So when she was given this light duty assignment, working at the front desk, was the township taking leave time away from her?
Yes, there was a computation of leave time.
So why isn't that a penalty? That was the reasonable accommodation, was to put her at the front desk, and now you penalized her by forcing her to give up leave time.
Because our position is that position at the front desk was not a sworn police officer position. There were duties that she was doing that did not were not normally done by a sworn police officer, and that because she was not able to carry a weapon and perform all of the duties that go along with the sworn police officer, she would not have been able to engage with the suspect. There was a list of things she testified to in a deposition that she could not and was unwilling to do. And I don't dispute that she had the ability and the right to say, I don't want to do that. I feel that that compromises my safety and my unborn child's safety. But my point being is that if she is not performing all of the essential duties of a police officer, that there was that position that we gave her was not a police, a full police officer position. It was a hodgepodge of here, you can from everything from you can make copies to you can be a file clerk, which is not something we hire a police officer and pay a police officer's salary to do.
The appellate division saw numerous causes of action available under this new subsection added, I'll call it subsection S. There's the unequal treatment, there is failure to accommodate, and then is there's the penalizing that Justice Albin just referred to. Do you believe that you're defending a case of unequal treatment based upon the original SOP? Is that how you are arguing this case to us, or are you saying that notwithstanding the SOP, you have tried to accommodate and she does not, you have not failed to accommodate under the language of this statute?
I'm going to say it's probably a double defense. The first step, as the appellate division noted, was the language of the policy. And then this, thereafter moving into whether or not it was a reasonable accommodation, what would the level of requirement and or does the undue hardship apply? So in my mind, it is a three-part analysis, one on the facial and then two subparts on the application of the statute.
The application being the failure to accommodate. So are you maintaining that the revised SOP is the accommodation that you're required to do?
Well, I believe the accommodations that would be required are irrespective of any SOP, which is that once the law was passed, we are required to provide a reasonable accommodation that allows the individual to perform the essential elements of their job. So if in this case, if Ms. Delanoy came in and said with a different gun belt, I can work, I would like an assignment in the building such as, and named three or four assignments that she felt she would be able to do inside of the building, our interactive process would trigger. And no matter what our policy said, it would not be applicable to her because we'd be talking about essential functions and fully performing police officer. It is only in the instance when she comes in and says no essential functions and no level of accommodation can allow me to complete all of my essential functions, then our policy comes in and says, even though you can't perform your essential functions, and this is inapplicable on its face to that extent, now we have a sub-level of assistance we can give you, which is even if you can't do your essential functions, we're still gonna try and do some stuff for you anyway. But we ask you to do some stuff as well, knowing that you're not at full responsibility.
And that's the reason why in your papers, you basically have said that your light duty program is a matter of grace. You basically said, we didn't have to do this. We're doing that because we're nice guys. Do I have that correct?
To the extent that the time the officers are on light duty, they cannot perform the full requirements, the full essential functions. Yes, but this was something in addition.
She has said, tell me if I'm mistaken, she cannot carry a weapon. Because she cannot fire the weapon because she feels that the lead that is produced from discharging a weapon may harm her pregnancy. Am I correct?
I believe that is a fair statement.
So are you now saying that pregnant women who cannot wear their weapons cannot have any reasonable accommodation provided by your township? Because they can't wear their service revolver? Is that your position?
I don't know if I'm willing to say it going quite that far, but I'm willing to say that once she said I can, not just the weapon, but the other aspects that she said she could not do.
Let's stick with the weapon. So then you can go on to others.
Sure. I don't know that I have thought through enough, but I don't know that the weapon alone might be enough to say not receive a reasonable accommodation. I am going to say though that under the totality, if it is weapon plus A plus B plus C. That's the analysis that has to be considered to determine that. We certainly know a weapon is one of the essential functions. It is not the only one, and there are other essential functions of a police officer.
Well, why weren't you obliged to tell her of the other reasonable accommodations available? Assume that wearing a weapon is not one of the essential functions. Like, why weren't you required to tell her you could have been a DARE officer, you could have been an evidence room officer, or you could have done other functions? Why wasn't that your obligation?
I believe it wasn't our obligation because she's the one who came in and started the process by saying, I can't, I can't, I can't. If she had come in and said, I have limitations, what are my options and what's available? But she started with defining. She defined for us that she could not do certain things.
Just to be clear, in New Jersey, in order to work, in order to be a police officer, are you required to qualify with and be able to carry a weapon so that once you cannot, you can no longer be a police officer in New Jersey?
That is correct.
But are I think we've asked this question before. Are there duties that can be a reasonable accommodation within the police department where she would not need to carry a weapon and therefore it could have been a reasonable accommodation? That's what we're trying to understand. I mean, in the evidence room, if she's reviewing gun permits, it was part of your list. She's reviewing gun permit applications. If she's reviewing evidence reports, is that something that she needed a weapon for?
I know of no department that does not have a requirement to say you don't wear your weapon. Every police officer in every headquarters wears their weapon while they are on duty unless they are in the cell block with prisoners.
So it seems to be the case that, to Justice Albin's point, that no pregnant police officer in that township would ever be able to qualify for a reasonable accommodation.
If she is,
that's what it sounds like.
Well, if she is unwilling to carry a weapon with her,
if she can't carry a weapon because it might be very dangerous to her condition as a pregnant woman, not that she's decided because she doesn't feel like it, because right. She is in a condition that might be dangerous to her pregnancy. That's why she's not able to carry a weapon.
I think the next level would be is she coming forward with and saying, what are my limitations or what can I do?
The regulation that regardless of your position, if you're active police officer, you're required to carry a weapon and be able to qualify under the weapon, whether you're checking kids across the crossing guard, or whether you're checking licenses somewhere, whether you're down in the basement looking at files, isn't it a requirement that every police officer be able to carry a weapon and be qualified to use it regardless of what their assignment is?
Yes, that is absolutely correct. Police officers have been terminated for failing to qualify. Officers are required to qualify twice a year. And if they fail to qualify, they are subject to termination proceedings, either through departmental and then to the superior court, or if they're civil service through OAL and
The whole purpose of this statute, tell me if I'm mistaken, is temporary reassignments. We're not talking about a permanent disability. The language of the statute talks about temporary transfers to less strenuous or hazardous work. It has in mind that there are jobs where typically someone may have to lift 100 pounds. When they're pregnant, they may only be able to lift 25 pounds. I suppose if the manufacturer said, well, 100 pounds is essential to the proper performance of the duties, this statute isn't going to come into play? It seems to me we're talking about reasonable common sense accommodations. Am I mistaken in terms of what the legislature was attempting to achieve?
Respectfully, my view on that is that is what the gun permit desk, what the evidence tech, what the school resource officer, what the traffic division officer would be the temporary assignment to less strenuous, less hazardous work than a patrol officer, while all of them being police officers, which is the position for which she's hired and paid and receives her full salary and pension credit for. I view those as the less strenuous, less hazardous assignments within that realm of police officer. I mean, for example, we could say she might make a great station commander, but that position is held generally by a sergeant or a lieutenant and not a police officer level of rank. So while there are other jobs that are assignments of a police officer, I believe are the jobs such as gun permits, traffic, maybe school resource officer, if she was able to, and her physician, and she concurred that she could do it. I think if she had a concern on one of them, then we get into the
analysis. Are you not required that you carry a gun as a DARE officer or filling out gun permits? And so that seems to be essential, because if she has to wear a gun, she's going to say, that's going to harm my pregnancy. No can do. Are you mandating this gun requirement?
Well, I'm saying certainly as a school resource officer, being in our schools with the potential for active shooters, I'm going to say that choice of assignment would certainly require a weapon. And generally, I, and with all due respect, the position of police officer requires carrying a weapon while on duty, unless, to my understanding, you're in a cell block dealing with a prisoner. That is the requirements of what police officers are required to do.
I think we have your position. Is there anything you'd like to add at this point?
I have nothing further right now. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Burke.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice.
I have one more question. I'm sorry, Chief, before you switch off. Just one more. I'm sorry. I apologize. Mr. Burke, the requirement that you be permitted to carry a weapon, that's not the township's requirement, is it? That's the state of New Jersey's requirement.
Yes, it is not the township's requirement.
So you can't waive that. Unless, I thought it was statutory, but maybe it's regulatory, or maybe it's the AG guidelines, but you can't waive it, only they could.
That would be correct.
Okay. I'm done, Chief, I apologize. I was on mute and I couldn't get it off.
No problem, Mr. Burke.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The legislature enacted the PWFA in 2013 as an amendment to the LAD. The LAD already prohibited discrimination, but the legislature wanted to ensure that employers were obligated, subject only to an undue hardship exception, which the employer would have to approve as an affirmative defense, to provide reasonable accommodations in the workplace to pregnant women upon their request, and not to penalize pregnant women because of their pregnant status. That is the intent of the legislature. And there's been a lot of discussion about what are the essential functions of the job, but there is absolutely no factual support whatsoever in this record that wearing a gun is an essential function of the job of a police officer. There's no testimony that that's the case. There is no legal support that that's the case. Whether or not a regulation exists has not even been posited by the defendants. So this conversation about, well, this is an essential function and it has to be, if the court will take note, there's no authority cited whatsoever in counsel's argument or counsel's brief for that assertion. So let's turn first to what the legislature requires pursuant to the plain language of the statute. That clearly is before the court. And frankly, I think the subjective facts on the ground in Ocean Township, which are not established at all on this record, despite any argument to the contrary now before the Supreme Court, it is the legislature's clear intent, which is paramount. And it's this court's duty to effectuate the intent of the legislature in interpreting the PWFA. Now, as Justice Albin previously noted, the statute expressly provides examples of required accommodations, including, quote, job restructuring or modified work schedules, end quote, temporary transfers to less strenuous or hazardous work, end quote. Nowhere in the statute is there any mention of the term essential functions, nor has there been any proof whatsoever on this record that wearing a gun is an essential function of the job. And Your Honors, if wearing a gun is an essential function of the job of a police officer such that no reasonable accommodation can be afforded, then women will not be police officers in the state of New Jersey if they want to have children. And that is exactly what this statute was designed to ensure diversity in the ranks. This is a police department that at all relevant times had three women on a force with over 50 patrol officers, not to mention more senior officers. When she became pregnant in 2011, Ms. Delanois, Officer Delanois, sought light duty. She did not, contrary to counsel's argument, state she could not do the job or she could not perform the essential function. She never used the term essential function. She sought light duty, which had routinely been provided to non-pregnant officers, males, on the force for time immemorial. And it's not her obligation to go to the employer and to list for the employer what she can do and what she can't do. Pursuant to settled law on in the disability area, the employer has an obligation to engage in the interactive process and to work with an employee to determine what functions the employee can perform. That was not done here. It wasn't even attempted to be done here. And that's completely ignored by the defendants. Our client did not go to the chief and say, I can't be a police officer. Our client went to the chief and said, I'm pregnant. Can you help me? Can you give me an accommodation like you've given all the other men all these years? It wasn't until 2011 that there was even a light duty policy because it was routinely granted at the discretion of the chief. It was only in 2011 that the chief decided to promulgate two policies, two separate but equal policies, a maternity standard operating procedure that even by its own title only applied to pregnant women, and a light duty policy that applied to everybody else. And I think it's somewhat interesting that counsel now argues the issue is moot. This argument that the issue is moot has never been raised by defendants prior to this morning before the Supreme Court in New Jersey. It wasn't raised before the appellate division. It wasn't raised in the briefs. This policy was defended in the law division. It was defended in the appellate division, and it was defended in the briefs before this court. As a number of justices rightly noted, this policy can be implemented tomorrow if the chief so determines. And so it's not so simple to say, well, you know, there's a new policy, so this policy is moot. There are issues with the new policy, by the way, but that's not before the court. What's before the court is the policy that was clearly applicable Officer Delanois was pregnant with her second child. And to be clear, this policy was not amended until after Officer Delanois had already given birth to her second child and had already been forced to give up all of her accumulated time in accordance with the terms of the maternity assignment SOP that was in effect. So I think it's important to go back to the language of the statute, because after all, that's what we're here for. That's what this court is required to interpret and effectuate, is the language of the statute. And where the language is clear, as it is here, there's not even a need to look to extraneous sources or try to divine the legislature's intent. The legislature was very clear, even as I mentioned earlier, listing examples of things that the employer would be required to do. And there's no facts whatsoever in this record that the plaintiff could be accommodated. I mean, if you think about it, even under the terms of the facially invalid maternity SOP, an accommodation would be provided. She would be penalized for that accommodation by being forced to give up her accumulated time, but she would receive an accommodation that would then be taken away based upon an arbitrary return to work date of 45 days after giving birth. So even under the defendant's own policy, which is facially invalid, an accommodation could be provided. The problem here is the reasonableness of the accommodation and the fact that plaintiff was penalized for seeking such an accommodation being forced to give up all of her accumulated time.
May I just ask you to clarify the precise theories that you're bringing plaintiff's action? I started to get into this with the township's attorney, but I really do want to talk to you about this. Is it purely a failure to accommodate claim? Is it also a separate claim for unequal treatment based on the first sentence of the paragraph? which the appellate division recognizes as a distinct cause of action, or is it both? They're somehow merging? And do you also believe, this is a multi-part question, that there is a separate cause of action for penalizing, if an employer penalizes an employee for requesting an accommodation? I'd like you to tease out your view of what are there three distinct causes of action, and what must be pled perhaps in the future for clarity so that defendants and courts know exactly what it is the plaintiff's theory of the cause of action is. We've asked for this information more recently in SEPA actions to help us understand a party's claim under multiple theories of SEPA. And I think courts may need that with regard to the PWFA.
Thank you, Your Honor. So to answer your Honor's question directly, I would say, yes, there are, depending on how you define the term causes of action, yes, there are really three distinct causes of action here under the PWFA. The first is the requirement of equal treatment. Mm-hmm. The first part of the statute clearly requires that employers treat pregnant workers similar to other non-pregnant employees in their ability or inability to work. So clearly there's an equal treatment requirement. But then the legislature goes further and says, not only do you have to treat them equally, which was already essentially a requirement of state law and federal law under the PDA, but you have to provide a reasonable accommodation, which is something that federal law does not require. So you have to go a step further than simply treating them the same and provide them a reasonable accommodation. So yes, if there's unequal treatment, that is a cause of action. If there's a failure to provide a reasonable accommodation, that is a cause of action. And then if you provide an accommodation but impose a penalty, as here, for the providing that reasonable accommodation, then that is also a cause of action because the statute prohibits penalizing a pregnant worker for seeking the accommodation. Here, I think—
May I stop you right there? So is your theory for the penalty aspect tied back to your unequal treatment claim based on the difference in how employees must use accumulated leave under the two different SOPs?
I think there's a number of ways and that there is some overlap, but first of all, the unequal treatment in the light duty policy, the chief can waive it. And in the maternity assignment policy, there's no language about waiver by the chief. So clearly there's, frankly, if we go back to the top of the policies, I think having a policy that only applies to one class of people, even if it's identical, I think we all have to sort of question whether or not that is problematic in and of itself. But when we turn to the language of the policy on its face allows the chief discretion for light duty, no such discretion for maternity assignment. Additionally, with regard to the calculation, as Your Honor was indicating, the maternity assignment policy sets an arbitrary date of 45 days from the pregnant employee's anticipated due date, so 45 days after giving birth, and then requires exhaustion of leave time working backwards. It's very, very confusing. I'm still, frankly, not sure I completely understand.
I'm glad I'm not the only one.
But what's clear is—
Counsel, tell me if I'm mistaken. This is focusing on one of the questions that Justice Levecki is asking. Doesn't the duty of reasonable accommodation require you not to penalize the employee? So for instance, absolutely. In this case, if you have an obligation to provide a reasonable accommodation, you can't start taking the person's accumulated leave time. Am I mistaken?
No, you're not mistaken at all. I think it's as clear as day. I mean, it basically what happened here was they said, we'll give you an accommodation, but you can't take vacation for the rest of the year. That's not reasonable. That's clearly a penalty. The facts on this record are that our client had to work on Thanksgiving, had to work on Christmas. This is a female officer with over 15 years on the force at that time, where junior males with 1 or 2 years are home with their families on Thanksgiving. And our client has the grandparents watching the baby because pursuant to the maternity assignment SOP, she's got to be on the road on Thanksgiving. if that's not a penalty, I don't know what is. And frankly, Your Honor, I think the appellate division didn't go far enough here, because the appellate division said, well, it's a factual issue about whether or not that's a penalty. Your Honor, where is the factual issue? What's the argument on the other side?
This is an accrued. So if you could please just restate, what are your theories factually in this case tied to the language of the statute?
The defendant's paternity assignment standard operating procedure violates the PWFA on its face. It does not provide equal treatment to pregnant workers.
So unequal treatment claim, right?
Unequal treatment. There was on this record a failure to provide a reasonable accommodation. There was no engagement in the interactive process by the employer. And despite a lot of argument of counsel, frankly, I would just say to the court, look to the record. Look to where any of those arguments are supported on the record, because there's not. There was no interactive process here. And now we can argue, but well, you know, she could have done X, Y, or Z. That's why we have discovery, because you can get the chief to testify or whoever else, you can proffer testimony and facts to say, here's what we had available, here's what we didn't, this is why it would have been a burden. That wasn't done here. It's too late before the Supreme Court of New Jersey to argue that this would have been an unconscionable burden when there are no facts on this record to support that. Certainly assigning a pregnant officer to a walk-in position where somebody had previously been assaulted in that same position, I don't believe was reasonable. But that's why you have to engage in the interactive process to determine what she can do, what she can't do, and what work is available. Now, the issue of the service weapon is not simply a matter of the discharge of the gun and the lead affecting the unborn child. There's testimony in the record, plaintiff testified as to this, as a woman gets closer to her due date, she grows. At some point, her duty belt does not fit. So it's physically impossible to wear the duty belt when you're 9 months pregnant. And to require that, to say, well, sorry, that's a requirement of being a police officer, as I stated earlier, that would mean that women who want to have children cannot be police officers. And finally, there's a penalty. That is the third prong here. Taking away the accumulated time as a requirement of being provided an alternative assignment was a penalty. My argument, Your Honors, is it was a penalty as a matter of law. There is no factual issue here. I think the court can decide that issue as a matter of law. But those are the three prongs of our argument, Your Honor.
Thank you.
As I stated earlier, the clearest intent of the legislature is the unambiguous statutory language. Here, the legislature intended to provide pregnant workers more than simply equal treatment. Pregnant workers are entitled to a reasonable accommodation for what is, in every case, merely a temporary medical condition. As set forth in the briefs of Amici, New Jersey law goes beyond federal law in this regard and provides important protections. This court must safeguard those protections for pregnant workers and interpret the law in a manner consistent with the clear and unambiguous language that the legislature chose when it enacted the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act. An interpretation faithful to the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act requires invalidating the defendant's maternity assignment standard operating procedure. At this point, my argument is concluded, but I'm certainly happy to answer additional questions if there are any.
I just have one last question. And that is, the appellate division remanded for fact finding by a jury, I suppose, whether or not providing a reasonable accommodation would constitute a hardship. Am I correct about that?
You are correct, Your Honor.
And if that's true, that would implicate the penalty issue. Because if a trier of fact found it was a hardship and therefore they didn't have to make a reasonable accommodation, therefore there would be no penalty. I think that may be the reasoning of the appellate division. Am I off about that?
Well, that's interesting, Your Honor. I see them separately. I think they're separate in the terms of the way they're laid out in the statute. I mean, I think part of the problem here is that we're all sort of grasping at straws because there was no development of the factual record on this issue. But certainly, even if let's put it this way. I don't think the penalty necessarily flows from whether or not there was an undue hardship. I think if there had been a proper engagement in the interactive process to determine the functions that the plaintiff could perform, alternative work could have been provided. It was clearly provided for a limited duration, and that would not have constituted a penalty. I think the problem here, Judge, is that Justice Albin, is that the statute clearly uses the term penalty. And I think that to leave it up to the discretion of a fact finder when there are really no facts whatsoever developed in the record, no facts below to suggest an undue hardship, no facts below to suggest that if the time was not forfeited, as counsel argues in her brief, that somehow that this would have had some detrimental impact on the Township of Ocean, we get beyond what factual issues are legitimately left for a jury to resolve. That's a long-winded way of answering Your Honor's question to state that the appellate division may have viewed them as linked in some way, although they didn't expressly state that. I see them as two separate issues, both pursuant to the statutory language and frankly, as a matter of fact.
Mr. Burke, one
may have just answered this question. Is there?
Go ahead, Chief. I'll ask.
Is there some potential for overlap among these two theories in terms of the facts?
Yes, I would say there is some potential for overlap. I think had the defendants had a serious position here, a serious argument to make, there would have been extensive factual development and a factual record to state, yes, this would have been in some sort of undue burden. Again, it would have depended upon the accommodation to deter. First, you need an interactive process to determine what the available accommodations are to then argue that none are available because of an undue burden. So we do need to follow steps here. It's like 1, 2, 3 before we get to the conclusion. We didn't even get to step one. And the defendants are trying to argue step three without any factual support. But yes, in theory, Your Honor, I do believe that there, depending on the facts, which we don't have here, there can be some overlap between undue hardship and penalty, frankly, perhaps in other contexts. But here,
between penalty and your claim for unequal treatment based upon the SOP on its face, because you were initially telling us that you saw on its face the SOP treating the calculation of leave time and when it started from as different for pregnant women as opposed to others asking for late duty. Or did I misunderstand that?
No, I want to make sure I understand Your Honor's question. I think it's both. I mean, it is invalid on its face because it sets an arbitrary return to work date with no reference to medical support, consultation with a doctor or anything like that. Unlike, by the way, the light duty policy, which states that the return to work date shall be established in consultation with a doctor.
Based on the language of the SOP, you have an unequal treatment claim and you have a penalty claim.
Yes, absolutely. And Your Honor, I want to argue too, and I think this should be preserved on remand, a failure to accommodate claim. There, I don't believe there was a reasonable accommodation here on this factual record.
I was just trying to understand the interconnectedness and separateness of your first claim and your third claim.
There is definitely a lot of overlap here, Your Honor. There's no question about that. But I hope I've answered Your Honor's question. And if I haven't, I'll try again.
Can I clarify two things very quickly? One is, you talked about no factual issue. You don't know what a trier of fact would consider. This was a summary judgment motion. And the granting of, was it not? And the granting of summary judgment was reversed. So presumably, all of the issues you raise would go back for consideration by the trier of fact. They're not concluded in any way for the plaintiff or the defendant, if you're successful, correct?
Respectfully, Your Honor, no, because we cross moved for summary judgment, and it's our position that our cross motion for summary judgment should have been granted.
Okay. But assuming that neither summary judgment motion is granted, the appellate division did not. Maybe they did. All right, you've answered that question. My second question is, you said that certainly there's a question here that was raised by defense counsel as to whether, and petitioner's counsel, the township, what are essential functions of the job that she could or could not perform? And you said nothing in the statute discusses essential functions of the job, but our case law relies on that and depends on that, does it not? And is there at least, if they are correct, that a police officer is required by, the Attorney General, by regulation, by statute, to carry a weapon, that is certainly an issue that there's no record on, apparently would need to be explored as to whether in fact it is an essential function of the job that they could or could not waive.
Your Honor, if hypothetically there was a state statute that said if a police officer can't carry a weapon, then a police officer can't be a police officer, which I don't believe exists, by the way. This court's mission would be to harmonize the PWFA with this other statute. But even if that were the case, the PWFA talks about job restructuring and talks about temporary reassignment. So even if that were the case, you know, that statute, which no one's, you know, cited, I mean, by the way, the facts on this record are that there are police officers in the Township of Ocean that don't carry their service weapons 24/7 or don't need to carry service weapons at all in the context.
No, that's not what I'm talking about. And I'm not saying just a statute. I'm not aware of a statute either. I think all of those requirements are set by the Attorney General and their regulations through the Police Training Commission. So I don't know, but I'm just suggesting to you that is that at least an issue or a question? And yeah, if it is an issue or question, we might have to deal with that in the context of both statutes, or we may have to require that there be a determination below. It may require remand on that basis only, since it's never been raised, I guess, or argued.
Correct, Your Honor. It was not raised below by the defendants. I think it's too late to raise it now. And even if it had been raised below, Your Honor, I believe that would be fundamentally a legal question. If we're talking about the interplay between two statutes or a statute and a regulation, these are legal determinations that would be up to this court to decide. But there is no factual record whatsoever. There's not even a development of a legal record to say, here are all the authorities that support our position. They just don't exist. I mean, you didn't even hear them this morning from counsel. So I think that I'm going to go back to the summary judgment standard. You know, the facts and the arguments have to gel by the time you get to summary judgment. And those matters have to be submitted to the court for a determination on the law and on the facts, depending.
That's not correct. All the summary judgment decides is whether there are material facts that will be left to the trier of fact. And whether there is an essential function that cannot be performed is a question of fact for a jury.
But it needs to be raised and there needs to be factual support in the record.
By the time it gets to a jury, you're right, but not by the time it gets to summary judgment.
Unless, I would disagree.
Unless we're talking about your cross motion.
Well, yeah, we are talking about our cross motion. I mean, to be clear, there was a motion and a cross motion. So that's the record. That's the record on this appeal, even that was part of the appendix. So, but no, I don't think, respectfully, Judge, I don't think you get to say, well, you know, there's no factual record. So I'm standing before the law division judge and say, well, I don't have any facts in the record and I don't have any legal support, but let me make the argument to a jury. I don't think that's the way it works, Your Honor. I think you have to develop the facts and you have to develop the law. and only if there's a legitimate factual question in light of the applicable legal standard do you proceed. You don't get to say, well, I don't have the facts and I don't have the law, but let me make the argument and see what a jury thinks.
I got you.
Other questions, anyone? Mr. Burke, is there anything you'd like to add?
No, thank you, Your Honor. Appreciate the court's consideration of this matter of utmost importance.
Thank you. And to the next three fine advocates, Amiki, we're going to try to limit the arguments to about 10 minutes each. Ms. Fu. You need to unmute, please.
Apologies. Good morning. May it please the court. The appellate division properly interpreted the New Jersey Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, and its decision should be affirmed for three main reasons. First, it properly recognized that the plain language of the Act affirmatively mandates that reasonable accommodations related to pregnancy be provided to allow a pregnant employee to continue working unless it would create an undue hardship on the employer's operations, and also that the Act prohibits actions that punish pregnant women for seeking or using these accommodations. Second, it respected the plain language of the Act in holding that a pregnant employee may be entitled to an accommodation of a temporary transfer to a less strenuous or hazardous work, even if she temporarily can't perform all of the functions of her job because she is pregnant. And lastly, it properly determined that whether violations of this act occurred in this case should be decided by the jury. So this morning, there's been a lot of questions about the essential duties of a position and to the extent that an employer can raise that. And I think it's helpful to and important to look at the plain words of the statute. And here, the legislature identified specifically that a reasonable accommodation in the case of pregnancy would be job restructuring, modified work schedules, temporary transfers to less strenuous or hazardous works. And in doing so, it communicated that there would be certain jobs in which a pregnant employee would need an accommodation to maintain a healthy pregnancy. The place at which I think Justice Solomon asked about the waiver of an essential job function, the place that the legislature contemplates that that analysis occurs is in the undue hardship analysis. That is where an employer can raise it. And it's not the only factor. It's one of several factors raised. And it would be far-reaching if, as a matter of law, an employer could argue that merely because a pregnant employee could not temporarily perform all the functions of her job because she is pregnant, that she would be automatically not entitled to an accommodation, that contradicts the plain words of the statute. And so I think that while both parties have raised plenty of facts that they believe supports their position, I think it's important to note that the appellate division in addressing that the lower court failed to acknowledge the proper application of the law, remanded this matter for a jury to decide and resolve all those factual determinations. Simply, if the accommodation can be provided without undue hardship, then the Act requires that it be provided. But if the proposed accommodation would impose an undue hardship, then the employer must support that position with the type of evidence identified in the statute. And whether or not the employer in this case can do so would be addressed before a jury, which is why the appellate division properly set forth in interpreting 12S, acknowledging the three different methods that a pregnancy discrimination claim could be raised and remanded for a jury to examine. The other issue that was raised before earlier this morning addressing what are the obligations of employers and employees? I think all we have to do is go to the plain words of the statute. The plain words of the statute contemplate that where an employee who is pregnant and is seeking accommodation for that pregnancy, she's obligated to provide her employer with the request, and it has to be based on the advice of a physician. And then at that point, the employer upon receiving that accommodation request, would then be able to examine whether or not they would be able to provide that. The requirement is mandatory. The words of the statute are very clear that where an employee can demonstrate that she would be seeking an accommodation based on her pregnancy, she should be able to receive it.
You're speaking on behalf of the Attorney General and interpreting the statute in particular as it applies to a police department today. Can you shed any light on the discussion that has taken place up until now with respect to an officer's ability or requirement to carry a weapon?
Sure, Your Honor. I think that all jobs are different, all employers are different, all job duties are different. And to the extent that the statute impacts women in the law enforcement arena, I think the place at which an employer is able to raise the fact that carrying a gun is an essential function of the job, I think that is a sort of case-by-case determination. I don't think that—
But as a matter of fact, is there a requirement that seems pretty basic to this case, by regulation, by AG directive, that a police officer be able to carry a gun?
So I think, Justice Patterson, I think the inquiry though would, I think to allow the focus to be merely on one aspect of a job duty.
I'm not asking for how everything fits together. I'm simply asking if you don't know, then the right answer is you don't know. Is there a regulation or AG directive that says that?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Thank you.
But I think it's important to note that if there were a regulation, that the inquiry must come from, you know, the employer and the employee on the ground. And so I think defendants have raised all of these arguments now in positions in which this particular plaintiff was unable to perform her full duties of her job. But I don't think that the record before us indicates what exactly her specific duties were and what accommodations could be allowed in that specific police department. I don't think that record—
You don't know what the policy is. How can you determine for us what the inquiry should be and how it should go, since you have no idea if there's a policy and what the policy would say?
I'm sorry.
You tell us how it should go?
I'm not sure I'm following your question.
You don't know if there's a policy, you told Justice Patterson.
I don't know.
If there was a policy, you wouldn't know what it says. But you tell us that the policy require an inquiry as to each job qualification that would be done. And what I'm asking you is, how do you know what that would be the case if you don't know what the policy is or even if one exists?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, Justice. I might have misunderstood Justice Patterson's question. I think I thought her question was whether or not I knew for certain that there was a directive that a police officer carry a gun. And
exactly.
I don't know.
And you said you didn't know. So I'm asking you how you can provide for us details as to how it should be enforced and what it would mean or not mean when you don't even know if there is one and what it would say if there was one.
But I think the issue here though is if what the police department is claiming here that she could not perform one of her many duties, that the determination as to whether or not that duty is an essential function of the job and that she could not perform it, that goes to the analysis of whether or not the reasonable accommodation would be an undue hardship. And I think—
You don't know what the policy would be or what the Attorney General would have enacted by way of policy. So we really can't possibly know what the inquiry would be or what the steps would be, since we don't know what the policy would say.
But that focus is just on one merely aspect of the job. And I would submit, Your Honor, that, you know, there are various different police departments in the state of New Jersey. There are various different duties. There are certainly different accommodations that could be.
I understand your position, man. Thank you.
Well, Counsel, are you telling us that if that is indeed the policy, that's not the end of the inquiry as relates to the PWFA?
That's right, Chief Justice Rabner. I think the plain words of the statute indicate that there would be a case-by-case analysis. There's an individual assessment to determine whether or not an employer could provide the reasonable accommodation to that particular police officer. I think that it is very important to note that because of the different characterizations of the different departments, you know, once and also to note that each officer, perhaps each pregnancy is different, each requirements are different. And in that way, I think it's important to note that what appears to have happened here is that when Officer Delanoy sought a light duty position, there did not appear to be any sort of specifics as to what she could do and what things were and what other alternatives she could have done in the workforce.
And this applies not just to police departments, but what I'm taking from you, from your argument, is that even when jobs have essential requirements, under this act, the employer has to see whether or not it can make a reasonable accommodation. And if it can, without it incurring a hardship, it has to do so.
That's right, Your Honor. I think that the words are very clear, and we could just go to the words. We don't really have to go to other extrinsic sources. It says, in addition, an employee shall make available to the employee a reasonable accommodation in the workplace for needs related to pregnancy. And so there has to be, again, a case-by-case individualized assessment. And I think that's very important when the appellate division acknowledged that and remanded this for a jury to decide.
What would be an example of an undue hardship that would meet the statutory standard in the setting of this case?
So in this case, I think that we would need to recognize that the undue hardship analysis references several different factors. So I think that the statute, in identifying these specific factors, provides us a framework to determine whether or not an undue hardship would arise in this case. And I'm reading straight from the statute, Your Honor. It would be factors include the overall size of the employer's business with respect to the number of employees, number and type of facilities, and size of budget.
I know exactly what it says. What in this setting of this case, as you've commented, obviously very familiar with the record of this case. What would be an example of a showing that would meet that?
So I think, Your Honor, in this particular case, with the facts that we have, you know, if defendant was able to show that in the moment that they received Officer Delanoy's request, the factors that sort of are raised here, that based on Officer Delanoy's limitations related to her pregnancy, that there was no accommodation available, that if it is true that she could not do all of the things that defendants referenced in their argument this morning, if that is the specific particulars of the job in the township, then I think they would be able to demonstrate based on that, as well as the noted factors in the undue hardship, right? I don't want to waste the court's time by repeating all of them in the analysis, but that would be a way in which the defendants could show that there was an undue hardship. And in that sense, you know, I think that earlier this morning, there was reference to various claims here. I think the fact that all these, the underlying facts overlay all the claims is important to note, because I think that's why a jury needs to resolve this. How the jury would ultimately determine if there was an undue hardship would affect the other parts of the inquiry.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add, Ms. Fu?
Just lastly, Your Honor, I think that with respect to this case, the court can provide appropriate guidance to trial courts by adopting the appellate division's proper plain reading of 12S, which recognize the three distinct legal theories for pregnancy discrimination and allow a jury to resolve all the underlying factual issues raised by the parties.
Thank you. Ms. Lo Cicero.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the court. In order to avoid duplication, I'd like to focus my argument on policy considerations. But before I get to that, I did want to just address one of the open questions. Even if there is a regulation about guns and police officers, it's hard to believe that it would require police officers to wear them all the time. But even assuming defendants can get there, I did want to raise that in the context of get there, meaning that there's a requirement that she wear her gun all the time on duty. In the context of disability, leaves of absence are appropriate temporary modifications. And that's in one of the regulations cited in the appellate division's decision. And so if we're going to look to other contexts, I think it's really important to think that in addition to job modifications or restructuring or schedule modifications, if necessary, then the defendants are obligated to offer a temporary leave of absence. So I would just wanted to raise that with the court. 85% of women become pregnant at least once in their lives, and they comprise more than half of the workforce. And the PWFA requires employers to treat pregnancy as the normal condition that it is and to create workplaces that account for it. New Jersey was one of the first states to pass a PWFA, and ours is amongst the strongest. In addition to the affirmative obligations to accommodate pregnancy, the statute protects workers by explicitly prohibiting penalties for an accommodation, and that's in addition to the existing anti-retaliatory protections in the LAD. And New Jersey's leadership and the comprehensive approach to ending pregnancy discrimination evinces a strong state public policy in favor of employers taking all reasonable steps to accommodate pregnant workers. There are professions like policing that at their inception never anticipated having pregnant workers. And the legislature has made clear through the PWFA and other LAD amendments that employers must take account of the human body, including bodies with disabilities and now pregnant bodies, and figure out a way to accommodate them in the workplace. The PWFA was necessary because of shortcomings with existing anti-discrimination protections. We know that the Federal Pregnancy Discrimination Act and the LAD corollary often were interpreted to protect pregnant workers from being treated worse than other employees, but that meant that employers could treat workers equally poorly. And they could limit accommodations to workers who were injured on the job, which necessarily excludes pregnant workers. Now, without accommodations, pregnant workers face impossible choices. They continue working, soldiering on against the advice of their healthcare providers, or they leave their jobs temporarily or permanently. And if they continue working on the job without accommodation, they face serious risks for negative outcomes for their pregnancy. But if they're coerced into taking unpaid leave or quitting, they face immediate and lifelong economic losses. And these consequences are especially severe when employers fail to accommodate jobs that are dangerous, and they may push women to leave professions where they're vastly underrepresented. And the legislature learned all about this during hearings on this bill. And so that brings me to the significance of the PWFA in the context of policing. The gender disparities in New Jersey's law enforcement agencies are stark. Women make up half of our state's population and participate in the workforce at a rate of 60%. Yet in 2016, women comprised only 10% of New Jersey law enforcement officers. New Jersey ranks behind more than 30 other jurisdictions in the participation of women in law enforcement professions. And in 2016, one third of New Jersey police departments had no women officers at all. So the PWFA is particularly critical to supporting the retention of advancement of women in law enforcement. As cataloged in our brief, AMICI have pointed to several cases across the country and in New Jersey where pregnant officers requested and were denied job modifications. And at least one of these cases was brought to the attention of the legislature. Law enforcement executives agree that a diverse police force is a more effective police force. And now more than ever, New Jersey police departments should be using every tool available to recruit and retain women officers. And the PWFA advances that goal. If police departments fail to support pregnant officers, it's not just the officers and their families that are harmed. So are New Jersey's communities. And so unless there are other questions, I would conclude by urging affirmance.
Thank you. Mr. Folkman.
Good morning, Chief Justice and Associate Justices. May it please the court and counsel. Excuse me. In the RASPA case, this court made a determination that there's a distinction between a permanent accommodation and a temporary accommodation. The court said the light duty positions were not intended to be a permanent post, but a temporary way station or bridge between an inability to work due to injury and a return to full employment status. They're intended to as a shield to protect the temporary disabled, and the court went on to say, not as a sword by which a person who is otherwise unqualified for the position can demand a permanent posting. Now, in this case, Ms. Delanoy did qualify as an officer. This is not like the Bramley case where the officer failed to pass the weapons test initially. She is capable of doing that, was capable of doing that, but on a temporary basis, she was asking for this accommodation that she not be required to carry a weapon. She followed the terms of the clear and unambiguous language of the Pregnancy Workers Fairness Act by getting a note from her doctor, and the doctor said she needs some accommodation. And as Justice Albin pointed out, there are jobs that are available in a police department that don't necessarily require you to use a weapon. So if someone's in the evidence closet, if someone's in the records room, they don't need the weapon there. And at this point in time, we're unaware, and Justice Fernandez-Vina asked, is there, and I believe Justice Patterson asked, is there a law, is there a regulation requiring that all officers carry a weapon? I'm unaware of it, but I haven't researched it, nor has anyone raised that as a requirement thus far. What we know is that in this instance, Ms. Delanoy complied with the obligations that she had, which was to request an accommodation, and that under the statute and the legislature, if I may, the legislature in its history of this act made clear that this purpose behind amending the LAD was to give additional protections to pregnant workers so that they'd be treated the same as other people in the long run, that they have a disability, but it's temporary. It's a temporary disability. And in an instance such as Ms. Delanoy, she requested this accommodation later on in her pregnancy. So if you have a situation like this, then you have a statute here which provides for the remedies. And the remedies, Justice Patterson, you did say, what are examples of an undue hardship? We don't know specifically. What we know is what the statute provides for in terms of examples. And certainly, you can make an argument that if you have a police department of two and one of the officers is out on disability, that it may be an undue hardship to that department. But in an instance where you have an officer who is disabled as a result of a workers' compensation injury on the job, and they can't work during, or that individual can't work during that period of time, will they be fired? Now, there obviously is case law which says that if you fire someone for filing a workers' compensation claim, that you have a retaliation claim as well. But that's one example. So in dealing with this, and Your Honor, Your Honors, I don't want to waste your time because the Amici before thoroughly evaluated all these issues, and we adopt their positions as Chief Justice Ravner asked that we do, rather than waste your time. We don't want to go over this again, but I'd welcome any questions you have. We would just state that NJAJ would request that the appellate division decision be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank
you. Ms. Kvorak, rebuttal? Please unmute yourself.
Thank you, I'll be brief. Justice Levecki, I had a question about the calculation of time, and I will just address it briefly. The theory behind the calculation of the time was that for pregnant officers, as your a woman advances further along in her pregnancy, the difficulties would be greater than at the earlier stages, such as wearing a gun belt around her waist. So the leave time was calculated at the back end, whereas an officer who is out with an injury would be most injured at the beginning of his leave and would recover as he went along. So the leave time was put in the opposite direction, if that helps to explain how the calculation of the leave time differed between the two policies. Another question that one of your honors had, and I apologize, I don't remember who, the question topic came up about wearing a gun belt. A gun belt being worn around the waist at 9 months pregnant, I would agree, would be a challenge under any set of circumstances. But for example, a reasonable accommodation would be a shoulder holster, which would allow the person to wear their firearm, but without having it weighing around their waist. Those to me are, that is to me is a perfect example of a reasonable accommodation. I can, yes.
I don't want to spend too much time on this. And if the answer is you don't know and it's not helpful, please feel free to say so. But what happens in practice to a police officer against whom a TRO has been entered in a domestic violence case with restrictions on gun use? Is the person put on leave? Is the person given an alternative position? Can you help us?
I don't know the answer to that on a global level. I know the Attorney General has a policy regarding domestic violence and police officers, and I would look to that policy for my information and answer to that question. However, that was leading into my next point, which was the Attorney General has not promulgated any type of policy with respect to pregnancy and police officers, because, for example, the one case that we did cite, Bramley, says an officer can be terminated for failing to qualify. But I can also add there's an Attorney General policy that requires officers to qualify with their firearms 2 times per year under a series of scenarios, daytime shooting, nighttime shooting, and the like. So clearly, every 6 months would come up at least once during a pregnancy and would place an officer in violation of an Attorney General policy. And there is no Attorney General policy that helps to bridge that gap or relieve an officer or department of that requirement.
Necessarily helps you to look at the representative of the Attorney General advocating on the opposite side of the issue.
I understand that, but at this point, if the Attorney General had promulgated policies with different instructions, we would be obligated to follow them, but they have not espoused that policy in any format applicable to their police departments when this act was passed. They have come to the table today, and I recognize and appreciate that, but when this was passed, they have sat silent for 6 years and now advocate something different where they didn't give us the benefit of their thinking on imposing these requirements at that time. I believe, and I don't mean to be disingenuous to them, but that they have come to this issue and they've raised it now. But even as we sit here today, they have not promulgated a pregnancy in policing guideline. There are probably 50, 70 guidelines and directives, including the Excellence in Policing Directives, 10 or 12 of which came out in December of last year. And yet here we stand 6 years after this amendment, and the Attorney General has not provided any uniform guidance to its 500 plus municipal agencies, county agencies, state agencies, to provide any guidance as to how this should be handled, imposing certain requirements and relieving of certain requirements, such as the requirement to qualify with your firearm 2 times per year.
I'm not sure that the absence of a directive of the nature that you've just suggested answers the question here today. I don't see how you get.
I don't know that it answers the question either, but I do know that had there been a directive, it would have answered many of the questions and problems that we have had, such as being in compliance with an officer qualifying 2 times per year, yet relieving them of a requirement to carry a firearm and qualify 2 times per year. Those two can't, to me, don't seem to be able to exist.
Department that you're speaking for today sought that information, asked that question of the Attorney General, and requested that guidance?
I do not know if they have. I cannot make that representation one way or the other.
Please go ahead.
And then just my last point being, one of the things that I would like to just add is there is the position of police officer. There are special police officers, special ones, special twos, and special threes. Special threes are newest who work in schools and are generally retired. Special one and special two are two subsets of police officers. The legislature has enacted statutes that set what are the functions and duties of police officers, I believe it is a special one, who does not and is not eligible to carry a firearm. And as we move up the list, the definition of what a special one, special two, and a regular police officer and special three are all set by statute as to those positions. Ms. Delanoy held the position of a police officer, not a special one who does not carry, nor a special three who is retired and can carry in a school setting for school security. I would just point out that those are some distinctions between what position she is fulfilling, whether she's fulfilling the position of a police officer or is asking really for some other type of position that is not a sworn police position, even albeit on a temporary basis, but is not able to fulfill those functions.
Thank you, Council.